Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Our guest on today's program is a well-known journalist author who is admired by millions of Americans. You've watched him as senior correspondent on PBS NewsHour. A lot of you will remember him from his NPR days and Talk of the Nation. I'm speaking, of course, of Ray Suarez. He's in town for a special broadcast on Channel 9 this evening and also to promote his latest book, Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. Many readers will be surprised at how much they don't know about that legacy, a legacy that began with the first European settlements established long before Jamestown or Plymouth Colony. It is especially timely now that Latinos have become the largest minority in the United States, and now that it is projected that minorities will become the American majority around 2040. Ray Suarez, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Great to be here, Don.
Do you agree that there are many people who probably don't like this population shift and may even fear it?
Look, it's deep in people to be suspicious of change and sometimes be made a little uncomfortable by it. But I think the more you understand it, the less there is to fear about it. All this is the latest chapter of a very old American story. And if you think of it that way, it's a little less scary.
But I wonder why so many of us don't know that story, or that part of the story.
We tended to think of history, American history, as something that started with some grumpy Protestants up in Massachusetts Bay and some gold diggers in Virginia in the early years of the 17th century, and then just headed steadily west. We don't think of it as three big European empires wrestling for domination on this enormous, rich continent. And when you look at American history that way, then the deposit of the French Empire and the Spanish Empire especially makes a lot more sense and gives you a more integrated view of American history.
Give us some sense, Ray, of what was going on before Jamestown, before Plymouth Colony.
Everybody was trying to get their foot in the door in the Western Hemisphere. The Portuguese, the Spaniards, the Swedes started colonies in what's now Delaware and Pennsylvania. The Scots, before Scotland became part of the United Kingdom, when they were an independent kingdom looking to expand their territories, sent explorers into what became Nova Scotia, but also a part of the coast of the southeastern United States, trying to get Scottish colonies set up. So everybody was hungrily eyeing the New World to see what they could get started there, and eventually whether it's French Huguenots or Swedes or the Dutch of New Amsterdam giving way to New York, three empires start to tell the story: France, Britain, and the Spanish Empire. And, you know, the Spaniards come north from Mexico. The French explore the headwaters of the Missouri and Mississippi rivers and extend their empire and the Catholic religion along those waterways. And the British start really expanding their footprint on the eastern seaboard and heading west.
And again, most people are thinking of what was going on up in New England 100 years after St. Augustine.
St. Augustine should be, along with Santa Fe and perhaps Los Angeles, one of the places that we think of as the birthplace of the modern United States. Instead of thinking of Plymouth Rock and Jamestown, we should widen that picture to include St. Augustine, San Antonio, Santa Fe, Los Angeles, because those are truly birthplaces, shared birthplaces for 21st century America.
And, oh, by the way, what language were they speaking?
Yes, the first European language spoken in what is now the United States was Spanish.
What is the difference, Ray, between — I've heard people ask this, and I'll have you answer it — the difference between Latino and Hispanic?
Hispanic was a designation created by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in the 1970s in advance of the 1980 census, as government workers tried to figure out a way to capture in one number Puerto Rican students in the Bronx in New York and Cuban students in Miami in Florida and Mexican students across the Southwest who needed help learning English, who had Spanish-speaking or almost entirely or dominant Spanish-speaking parents. And there was no one metric that would capture them all. Yes, their national origins were different, but the problems were the same. A substandard house in Los Angeles, the weather might be better, but, you know, a substandard house is a substandard house, as is one on Blue Island Avenue in Chicago or the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. So they were looking for a definition, and a government bureaucrat came up with Hispanic because that expressed the commonality of the Spanish language and their roots in the Spanish Empire and the New World of all these different people.
So we can thank the bureaucrats.
We can thank the bureaucrats. And Latino is a word that the people themselves started to use, but different people at different times in a way that made it not totally accepted. The great Cuban singer Celia Cruz sang a song when I was a little boy saying, you know, it just isn't important. You could be from Mexico, you could be from Cuba, you can be from Puerto Rico, but once we're here, we're all Latinos. And I remember that song from when I was a kid. The great Ruben Blades, the fabulous Panamanian salsa band leader, in his song Plástico, sings at the end, listen, amigo, listen, friend, listen, Latino. You have your heritage and don't sell it out for gold. And I was a teenager then. So it was Latino was very easy for me. I always thought of it as much more appealing and much more inclusive than Hispanic. And it had the benefit of not being cooked up in a Washington Washington office.
Yeah, you know, I would tend to think that most non-Latinos, if they were asked to name a Latino singer, would probably come up with Desi Arnaz, and that's about it. And
Desi Arnaz, if they're a certain age.
Gloria Estefan, yeah.
My kid's age, they have no idea who Desi Arnaz is. But Desi Arnaz is an important part, I think, of our entry into American culture because he was a big TV star. I think now that we're in a 500-channel universe, we forget the old three-channel universe in which Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, who were not only co-stars but business partners in Desilu Productions, how important they were to early television. And he was a big, big star. And the idea of an immigrant with an accent, with American neighbors, the Mertzes, who accepted him on terms for what he was, and that was an important moment in the culture, I think. I Love Lucy.
There are a lot of things going on in the 50s. I'm getting a little ahead of myself in terms of how I wanted to go through this. But a lot of things going on in the 50s. And for those who may not understand, although I Love Lucy is probably playing somewhere right now.
You bet.
It's been playing ever since that time. He was a landmark, if you will. That's the wrong word. But he was a force because of his business acumen and because of the popularity of that show.
They were among the inventors of modern television. They launched a lot of series, and they made a lot of money. And, you know, he was a guy. He was from the Cuban aristocracy, well-born and well-educated. He met Lucille Ball in a canteen for GIs in Hollywood in the late 40s or early 50s. And when they cooked up that series, originally they were both going to be entertainers. And the series was going to be about the foibles and challenges of being a working showbiz couple named the Lopezes. Mm-hmm. And they reimagined it as a band leader married to a stay-at-home homemaker. And, you know, he's foreign, she's native-born. Comedic gold ensues, you know, and it was a huge hit.
The program was a huge hit, but I wonder what inroads were made through his popularity and their popularity in this kind of xenophobic society that we've been living in for a long time.
Well, you got to remember that was before the Cuban Revolution, before hundreds of thousands of people came pouring out of Cuba to escape the Castro regime. He was light-skinned, a Creole of more Spanish, Castilian physical appearance than the much more Indian or black Caribbeans. I don't think that would have flown on television in the 1950s to have red-haired Lucille Ball from Jamestown, New York, married to someone who was less apparently Caucasian in their appearance. And, yeah, I mean, it was a different world. The Latino population of the country was still pretty small in 1950 and largely confined geographically to South Florida, New York, and the southwestern United States.
It was a time when a lot of people from Puerto Rico, which is your heritage, is Puerto Rican, were coming certainly to New York. And a lot of people didn't like that then. They were, you know, they were feared.
New York was going through wrenching change. White flight, industrial decline, some really tough, tough times. I sometimes wonder how things might have been different had Puerto Ricans gone somewhere else in the United States. They went to what was at that time a city that was like a colossus, that looked at the rest of the country from an Olympian height, but was right on the precipice before three decades of a fall. And Puerto Ricans had very challenging times in America because New York wasn't growing as they were growing inside the city and still arriving by the hundreds of thousands.
The economy, the economic situation always plays a part when people begin to resent newcomers. And that's to a large degree what's going on here right now.
Sure. We didn't hear the occasionally ugly, passionate, emotional debates over immigration reform in 1998 or 1999, when the Dow was felt like it was doubling every couple of years and jobs were plentiful, labor demand was high, unemployment was low, and people were really, a lot of Americans were really making some serious money. You didn't hear so much about the problem with Mexicans working on construction sites in Denver or Phoenix or Los Angeles or San Diego. You didn't hear problems spoken of quite so angrily of people who don't speak English yet in Miami-Dade. Those things came to the fore when Americans were a little insecure, a little scared, not sure that they were going to do well. You know, the Great Recession, I think, threw us for an economic loop, sure, but psychically they were tremendously damaging. And I don't think we've taken full account of that yet.
And there's been a lot of hurt, a lot of pain. I mean, a lot
of
people have been.
And that's real. And that's real. And you don't expect people to say, oh, sure, at a time when there aren't enough jobs, bring in another couple of 100,000 people from somewhere else in the world. I get that.
Yeah. Ray Suarez is our guest. He's senior correspondent for PBS NewsHour and author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. By the way, Ray will be moderating a special program broadcast live on Channel 9 tonight at 7 o'clock. It's the American Graduate Community Town Hall, a discussion on how the community can help students face today's challenges. That's at 7 o'clock on Channel 9. It will be repeated on September 18th, 21st, and 22nd. We'll come back to continue our conversation with Ray Suarez in just a moment. Invite your calls as well at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we will, of course, take a tweet. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Ray Suarez of PBS. Ray, you say in your book that you wanted people to say at some point during it that, gee, I didn't know that. What are some of the things that you hope they're saying that about?
I hope they come to like and read more about Jose Marti, one of the great Latino intellectuals of the second half of the 19th century, one of the fathers of Cuban independence, and a man who was a working journalist during 11 years in exile in the United States, someone who came to know this country well, who covered the opening of the Brooklyn Bridge. He covered the trial of the assassin of President James A. Garfield. He covered the trial of the Haymarket rioters in Chicago. He was a fascinating guy and also a very prescient guy about growing American power, growing American wealth, and what it would mean to Latin America during the 20th century, which he didn't live to see. He died very young.
Radio Martí still in operation?
Radio Martí is still very much in operation, and it's been augmented by a TV service as well, operated by the U.S. government, beamed toward Cuba, blocked by the Castro regime most of the time, but still heard to some degree on the island.
I have to tell you, my brother helped put Radio Martí on the air a good many years ago.
Really?
Yeah. So a little bit close to that. But it was, he tells the story of how difficult it was. I think his office was lead encased because there was so much animosity at the time that there was fear for the people who were involved in that.
You know, Cuba is part of America's unfinished business from the legacy of the Cold War and the 20th century. And it's a funny world where we can both be critical in the United States of Chinese human rights violations or China's treatment of its journalists or its workers, for that matter, and then get on a plane and fly to Beijing and go walk on the Great Wall and buy postcards and have our pictures taken, while 90 miles off of Florida, there's another communist country that we can't visit, we can't see, we are shut off from in a weird kind of way. I've been to Cuba as a reporter twice, spoken to Cubans there who both love and resent the United States, and I've spoken to Cubans in America who both love and resent Cuba, and it seems to me that there should be some other way around this. Maybe one of our next presidents will figure it out.
But it is opening up somewhat, is it not? I mean, we've done programs here of people who have, there have been various missions, cultural missions, what have you. I have relatives who have gone to Havana to visit just as tourists. It seems to be more open now than it was just a few years ago.
If you go on an educational tour, if you are an education worker, a professor, a researcher, if you are a cultural professional, a musician, a poet, a writer, or a journalist, it's easy to go, or if you're Cuban. But for most Americans, Cuba is still a difficult place to see and a difficult place to get permission from the United States to spend money in. Yet at the same time, paradoxically, the United States is the number one supplier of foodstuffs by tonnage to Cuba.
Are we just waiting for Fidel to go to his great reward, if that's the right?
Such as it is.
Yes,
I think certainly the departure of the Castro brothers, Raul and Fidel, will clear the way for some other kind of relationship between the United States and Cuba that is not possible now.
One of the things I've observed, Ray Suarez, that it's just a personal observation, is that people who come to this country from other countries tend to be more patriotic than many of the people who have been here since day one.
Well, because when you are an American by choice rather than by birth, you tend to see that gesture of becoming part of this country as a much more momentous thing. I think that's natural and understandable. They also vote at higher rates than native-born people, naturalized Americans. And they see the choice to become an American as a very important day in your life, while you and I were just born here. And we didn't really have to do anything to be part of this place except first draw a breath, and then we were in.
You really don't get it as a Native American unless you've lived someplace outside of this country for a while and really realize what we've got going on here.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The rest of the world looks at the United States with this amazing mixture of longing, affection, admiration, and disdain, which sometimes it's expressed within 5 minutes of the same conversation. You know, I've covered stories in a lot of countries in the world, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe, and the remarkable piece of real estate that the United States takes up in the world's mind, whether you're sitting in a cafe in Tanzania on the Indian coast of Africa, or you know, walking down a street in Guatemala or in a pharmacy in Indonesia, when people hear you're Americans, they want to talk. They want to tell you what they think about the state of the world and ask you questions about America. It is amazing how much of a swath we cut through the world. 5% of the world's people.
5%, right. Where do you think it's going here with regard, you know, I guess most people are conceding that immigration reform is a dead issue for the foreseeable future. Do you see the DREAM Act and things such as that rising to the surface once again in the not-too-distant future?
The people who are watching this for a living, because they're elected officials and appointed officials, are quietly saying that comprehensive reform is looking pretty doubtful for this Congress. But they're hoping that at least parts of a comprehensive bill could be passed by this Congress to set the stage for further debates down the road. The Dreamers themselves, that is, foreign-born children of illegal immigrants who were brought here as minors, may have a shot in this Congress. Certainly border security, if you pair it with a DREAM Act, might have a shot. And everybody's looking nervously at 2016 because they don't know if they're going to get spanked or celebrated for not being able to pull the trigger on comprehensive reform.
And here it is only 2013. I mean, we don't have a lot of time between election cycles here, do we?
Well, the first primaries for the 2014 midterms are in just a matter of months, and that's really the matter of months that Congress has to act. And right now with Syria and the debt ceiling and the final implementation of Obamacare, you know, immigration is sort of getting lost in the scrum.
Again, let's take some phone calls. Ray Suarez. We'll begin with Scott calling from Chesterfield. Scott, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, we need more immigrants to help pay for Social Security and Medicare, and especially in the future. And also, what do you think about Glenn Beck saying that Marco Rubio is a piece of garbage?
Well, I'm not aware that Glenn Beck said that or the context in which he said it. I would hope that no commentator in the popular media would call any United States senator a piece of garbage. But, oh, well, I don't know what to make of that. I guess I'd need to know more about it. As far as the demographic challenges and the actuarial challenges, the people who run Social Security say that the finances of the program would be helped certainly in the near term by making legal those 11 million or so Americans who are in the country without documents, who are working illegally, because they would start to pay in, and the billions of dollars they've already paid into the system would not be credited toward their time in. Right now, Social Security collects billions of dollars from illegal immigrants that are not going to be paid in benefits. So that's one terrible legacy of keeping things the way they are. But what immigrants, legal and illegal, do is keeps the median age of the country down. That means a bigger chunk of the population has its Social Security's receiving years further off and has kids who are going to pay into the system too.
Yeah. One of the notes from your book I have here, the average age of Latinos in this country is 27. That's pretty young. It's well below the national average.
12 years below the
12
national
average. Years. So beyond Social Security, what are the implications of that?
It's going to be felt in school systems. It's already being felt in school systems around the country. It's going to be felt in our politics, not right away, but 50,000 Latinos turn 18 every month and will turn 18 every month deep into the 2020s. So that's a lot of people who will be eligible for the voter rolls, and the big challenge for both big parties is to get them registered and get them voting. It's going to have a big challenge for our higher education system, as colleges in the United States will be looking at a much more Latino student body in the 2020s and 2030s, and will have to address the needs of that clientele in a way that they're not addressing them now, or don't feel that they have to address them now. We're going to need a lot of houses. We're going to need a lot of, I think, alternative arrangements. It'll be interesting to see. You know, Latinos don't use old age homes very heavily compared to other Americans. Some of it is because they tend to be poorer. The families have lower median income, but also because that is not a tradition in Latino families. So whether this big group of Americans gradually conforms to the American model and puts more emphasis on the nuclear family and less on the extended family, or whether they force a change on America by treating old people differently, that remains to be seen. We don't know whether we're going to make America more like us in the coming decades or whether we're going to become more like America.
Remains to be seen. Ray Suarez, our guest. And by the way, this topic will be continued tomorrow on PBS. It's beginning to air a six-part series titled Latino Americans. It begins at 7 o'clock tomorrow night and continuing on September 24th and October 1st. We have more information on our website, but that's on Channel 9 starting tomorrow. Ray Suarez with us in studio. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment and take more of your questions on the phone and by email, whatever. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Ray Suarez of PBS. But before we continue, here are some of the stories that are happening now. One shooting suspect is dead, and D.C. police say a manhunt is underway for two other potential suspects in a shooting which took place at the Washington Navy Yard this morning. Federal law enforcement cautions that in the confusion, witnesses may have been confused and thought first responders were additional attackers. Police say there are multiple fatalities. Less than an hour ago, President Obama called the shooting a cowardly act and expressed his hope for a seamless investigation. The Washington Navy Yard is about a mile and a half southeast of the U.S. Capitol. And here locally, St. Louis Circuit Court judges voted down a proposal to create a separate docket for gun cases. Advocates of the proposal, which included Mayor Francis Slay, argued armed offender suspects wait too long to see a judge under the current system. The judges did, however, agree to give those cases priority on already established dockets. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Another terrible story, a shooting story. This one out of Washington, Ray Suarez. They just don't seem to go away, do they?
And, you know, I've been to the Navy Yard on several occasions, and I don't know how you get a weapon in there. Mm-hmm. It's a place where you can't just come in off the street. It's very well guarded. So I'll be very curious to see who these suspects are and how these weapons were brought into a military facility. Very interesting.
We are so plagued by stories just like this and have been. We just, I guess the shock sometimes is a little less each time it happens for some people because it's so persistent. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Peter calling from Florissant. Peter, go ahead. You're on the air with Ray Suarez.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Are you there?
Yes,
sure.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, good. In reference to the discussion early in the program, less than 30 miles from where you guys are sitting, you had that influence of the three nations that had so much influence on this country. I live in Florissant, which is from the French, Florissant, but before that, it was the township of St. Ferdinand, and it was named after Ferdinand, the King of Spain. Settled by the Spaniards, we have a park out here called Spanish Land Grand Park. We have Casa Alvarez that was the commandant's home, all kinds of neat historical stuff. Then later on, the French settled here, and much later, the Germans as well. It's a lot of people think of Florissant as a suburb of St. Louis, but until about 50 years ago, it was its own entity. It was a small town with a lot of history. Lewis and Clark passed through here and all kinds of stuff. I just wanted to comment about that. And one other thing I have to get in real quickly, I always comment about what a jewel Don Morsch is to the St. Louis area, but I really miss Talk of the Nation. And most of all, they've had a lot of great hosts, but I really miss Ray Suarez. He was the best. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks a lot, Peter. It's always nice to hear. That was one of the greatest times in my career. I loved being the host of Talk of the Nation. And thank you for reminding St. Louisans of of the important crossroads that this part of the Mississippi Basin was, where those three empires kind of collide.
Yeah, there's a lot of remnants of all of that still with us today. You know, Ray, there are a lot of people who would suggest, and you see this a lot through the media, our media, that the Latino population in this country is a monolithic group. What do you say to that?
Well, they tend to think of them that way. And I guess from outside the family looking in, you might be forgiven for thinking that. Obviously, there are differences inside the community, and certainly Guatemalans think of themselves differently from Mexicans, who think of themselves differently from Puerto Ricans, and on and on and on. But at the same time, there is a certain generational attitude that I'm seeing more and more in my kids' generation. They are very comfortable with the idea that, you know, once everybody gets here and lives here, we're all Latinos, and my daughters call themselves Latinas, and they're very comfortable with that notion and don't make a lot of difference between they themselves and their Cuban friends and Salvadoran friends and on and on and on.
I bring that up because there are a lot of people suggesting and writing today that the Republican Party doesn't get this group and had better work a little bit harder to woo the Latino community here, because it'll devastate the party politically if they don't.
If you talk to former Secretary of Commerce Gutierrez or Colin Powell or certain other Republicans, even Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, John McCain, they are wringing their hands with agitation over what they see as fumbling a historic chance to be able to speak to this fast-growing population and appeal to them at a time when their vote is perceived to still be somewhat up for grabs. You know, in the early election cycles of a young voter, if you capture their allegiance for a couple of go-rounds, you've pretty much got them for a long time to come. And numbers crunchers in the Republican Party, political pros who look at the trajectory of the most recent presidential campaigns, are seeing things that they consider very disturbing when they look at the Latino population, which is taking certain states off the map for them. Colorado. California is solid blue for as long as the eye can see because of that growing Latino population, and they're worried about Texas next. Florida's purple because of Latinos. Virginia is purple because of Latinos. Illinois, which was a state that could go either way in national cycles, is now solid blue and perceived to be that way for a long time to come. This is something that, while it's concerning some Republicans, there are others, members of Congress, people who are influential in party circles, who demean, make fun of, disparage Latinos in really ugly language, so that even people who are here legally, or Cubans and Puerto Ricans who have no immigration problems at all, one because they're American citizens or two because of wet foot, dry foot, hear that and say, look, they may not think they're talking about me, but they're talking about me.
And the number is 50 million right now. What is it projected to be in the not too distant future?
Well, it was 50 million, 51.5 million at the time of the census. It's roughly 53 million now, and is projected to be 130 million by 2040.
You know, one of the things that I have heard, I'd be interested in your take on this. It's in conjunction with this kind of paranoia that exists in the country today, is that the Hispanic population is growing so quickly in the states that you have mentioned that at some point, not too far down the road, there will be Hispanic majorities who could vote to have those states secede from the Union.
A fantasy, an interesting fantasy, but nothing more or less than a fantasy.
But it does feed, fuel the flames, if you will, of people
I guess so.
who want to believe this sort of thing.
You know, of all the things we have to worry about as a country, I think that is so far down the list that really don't worry yourself.
So California, Arizona, and Texas are going to be with us for a while.
You bet.
Of course, Rick Perry had some comments on secession, as I recall, before the last political campaign. So who knows about Texas? Let's go back to the phones. Jack in St. Louis County, go ahead. You're on the air.
I've got about three things to say, but on the topic you were just the difference between Hispanic and Latino technically is over the language, they're not totally synonyms. So Hispanics excludes Brazilian, I presume. But this, I don't see immigration fight being that much tougher now than it was during George Bush, because he wanted to reform it. And, you know, this goes all the way back to the Know-Nothings, or to, you know, at least the mid-19th century. But with Latinos, I think it came about in the first anti-marijuana legislation in the 30s. But I hope I'm not changing it unfairly to ask Ray's opinion on Syria, since this seems to be a kind of unique moment. It reminds me of 2003 when the approval Bush had allowed him to be pushing Saddam back, and we never found out how far we could push Saddam back. Whereas President Obama is using that effectively, and I trust him not to go into war the way Bush did. And I'm startled at how unified, almost unified, the media is in saying what a terrible job the president has done. I think he's done an unbelievable job. And
it's interesting. I have rarely seen the kind of unanimity between Republicans and Democrats on any issue than what you hear in not wanting to get involved in another country in the Middle East. I have no opinion on it and will express no opinion on it. But as a reporter, I can tell you that I've been surprised. I expected, because I've been traveling a lot in the last 2 weeks, I expected that I would hear more of a mix of people seeing the Obama administration's point, but understanding how difficult the policy was, or wanting to do something about Assad, but not sure what it was right to do, or so on. A great degree of skepticism, a great degree of mistrust, and I think some of it comes from the fact that we've been at war basically nonstop since a couple of weeks after 9/11.
I think the Pew polls are showing that more than 60% of the American public are saying, hands off, we don't want any part of this. So there's a lot of response in the political world to that, certainly.
Sure. And it just has been interesting also to see people who were very aggressively beating the drum for retaliation against Saddam, who hadn't done anything to the United States, who are now perhaps chastened by the terrible experience of that war, and also hearing from their constituents at the same time who want no part of it.
And a lot of people are suggesting there's a certain degree of hypocrisy there as well. That's what some people think. Let's go back to the phones. Jerry and O'Fallon, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air with Ray Suarez.
Good morning, and welcome to St. Louis. I find it particularly distressing that there seems to be, there's a reactionary, at least among a percentage of our population, deep reactionary feeling about Hispanic, Latino immigrants, et cetera. And I think part of that is kind of based on, you hear this, and this is America, we speak English, and people are ignorant of the fact that in many states such as Pennsylvania, over 100 years ago, they conducted court proceedings in German because, and I come from an Italian background. There were several sections of cities, large cities, where you would think you were in Italy because it was the only language spoken. And I guess it has something to do with that. One of the responses I often hear and criticism of usually President Obama, he's not one of us. And I guess us means just yeah, you're welcome to immigrate, or emigrate to the United States with as long as you're from a Northern European background. But somehow people who are perceived as different are somehow more dangerous. And I think that's, I'm sure I'm telling Noah about rain telling you about this, but I find that to be particularly, you know, until people can get over that, it's just going to be more and more of this, you know, more noise than anything else. But it does affect people. So anyway.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book, and one of the reasons the PBS series, which debuts tomorrow night, tells its story in the way it does, is that we want to remind Americans that Latinos are unique among all American ethnic groups in that they were here before there was a United States. They were settled in places that became the United States before the United States came to them. And they got here the day before yesterday. That's true, too. If you look at all other big ethnic groups, the Poles, the Germans, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews of Eastern Europe, there was a run-up, then a huge spike, then a subsidence, and then a tapering off to nothing in their arrival in the United States. Latinos are different in that, A, they were already here, and B, their continued arrival through different centuries, through different generations, remains high, remains steady, and presumably will remain for years to come unless we become really exclusionary about our immigration policy. But the die is cast demographically. We are going to be a country with a large chunk of its people at long last, a historical anomaly, tracing their origin not to Europe. We'll hit that in 2040, 2043, when people who trace their family backgrounds to Europe will become a minority of Americans. Is the sky going to fall? No, it's not, because America's still going to look like America, work like America, act like America, and think like America. When you go to the north side of Chicago on Sunday afternoon and go to a Bears football watching party and people are wearing jerseys and yelling at the screen, but they happen to be watching Fox Deportes instead of the NFL on whatever, CBS, they are in the act of becoming Americans. You're catching them right there in the act. They think of themselves as Chicagoans, not as Mexicans from Mexico. They think of themselves as this new hybrid people, but they are primarily American, and they are part of this country and part of its culture, and they're not going anywhere. So all of us, those of us who are inside that group and standing outside of it deciding what to make of it, we gotta just calm down a little bit and take a deep breath.
It's been interesting to watch the growth of Univision and what it's done. And in fact, it's taken overtaken at least one of the major networks in this country. It's really making its presence felt, isn't it?
And Univision Late Local News beats the English language Late Local News in many marketplaces now in the country, New York, Los Angeles, and others. Will that change over time? You bet it will, because the American pattern of acculturation is that grandchildren rarely consume media in the language of their grandparents when they come from immigrant families. And that is proving to be no different among Latinos, where the grandchildren may still speak some Spanish, but they are less likely to consume their media in Spanish. So, you know, the idea that we're going to be another Canada, that we're going to have an internal Quebec with language laws and all that stuff, that historical analogy just doesn't fit. We are a place where people who come from Spanish-speaking families are acquiring English at the same rate as other immigrant groups have in our history. And that part hasn't changed.
You know, there are a lot of ironies in today's world. And one of them is that while, again, I cite the fact that a lot of people are concerned about newcomers coming in, that places like St. Louis, and St. Louis is very active in this, are doing their best to attract immigrants and refugees because of the economic impact they have on a community. They come in, they work hard, they establish businesses, they hire people. They and those people spend money in that community.
And they revive neighborhoods.
If you look at parts of the urban fabric where on commercial streets there were vacant stores or places that stayed for rent way longer than they used to, when you get a new population that comes in, it's like bringing the circulation back to a limb. Suddenly there are people on the streets again. Because the rents have declined, immigrant entrepreneurs can actually afford the table stakes for getting into business. And it's part of the life cycle of neighborhoods.
And that's what a lot of people should be thinking about and looking at as opposed to some of the other things on their mind. Let's take another call. Tom in South County, go ahead.
Thanks. And you both touched on just what I wanted to ask about. Mr. Suarez, when I was growing up here in St. Louis, I'm in my 40s now, the European ethnic groups that had been seen as ethnic, you know, earlier in American history, like the Irish and Italians, had pretty much assimilated. And St. Louis was very segregated, white and black. And now you can go into areas like Donald Noir, Cherokee Street area, and you see Latinos and you see people from former Yugoslavia, Southeast Asia, African American, Anglos, all using the same neighborhood. And it makes you feel like whatever your background is, you know, you don't feel like you're not supposed to be there. And it reminded me of a time when I was in an area of Queens, by Queensboro Plaza, and it was just so ethnically mixed. It wasn't ghettoized. And I wonder if you experienced that growing up and if you think that's the future for America, because it really is saving some neighborhoods here in St. Louis.
Well, I grew up right next door to Queens in Brooklyn. And yes, the Brooklyn of my youth was and is very ethnically diverse. But I'm glad you brought up Queens because it's the most diverse county in the United States. It's the United Nations on the hoof. It's an amazing place. And places like Queensboro Plaza with Korean and Colombian merchants and Peruvian merchants and Greeks and all, it's an amazing place. There's very little like it in the rest of the country. There are many states in the United States that have not been attractive to or have not been traditional ports of arrival for immigrants. And St. Louis, Missouri, writ large, and also the southeastern United States have not been, if you look over the long arc of American history, places where immigrants have traditionally gone.
And yet in the 1850s, the middle of that century, there were more immigrants in St. Louis than there were in New York City.
But by 75 years later, the southeastern United States are the most uniformly native-born part of the United States. And the real divide was, as the caller mentions, between black and white rather than between different ethnic groups.
We have a little bit more than a minute left, Ray. Tell folks what they can expect on your town hall meeting tonight on Channel 9.
We're bringing together the big stakeholders in education, parents, teachers, administrators, and business people, all looking anxiously to hear about how St. Louis and the surrounding region can improve its schools, raise the achievement of our students, and thus make this a more viable place economically and guarantee a better future, both for the kids and for the state and community writ large. So please join us tonight on PBS 9.
And this is just part of an overall PBS project, is it not?
The American Graduate Project. I've done it in other places in the country. Now I'll be going to New York. I've done it in Las Vegas and Albuquerque. So St. Louis, just the latest stop on a long effort by public broadcasting to raise the high school graduation rate in America.
Yeah, well, that's an important subject. Certainly is in this community. Ray Suarez will be moderating that special program broadcast live on Channel 9 tonight at 7 o'clock. It's the American Graduate Community Town Hall, a discussion on how the community, as you've just heard, can help students and communities face today's challenges. 7 o'clock on Channel 9. It will be repeated on September 18th, 21st, and 22nd. And PBS will also air a six-part series titled Latino Americans, beginning at 7 o'clock tomorrow night and continuing on September 24th and October 1st. We have information on all of this on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Your book, Latino Americans, the 500-Year Legacy That Shaped a Nation, is a companion to the program that begins tomorrow night.
And it's also an audio book, so if you want to hear me read it to you, if you don't want to read it yourself, go ahead.
And as I said to you as you came into the studio today, it's an important book. All of us should read this, and I guarantee that they'll abide by what you said when you said, I hope people will say, gee, I didn't know that when they get through that book. Thank you, Ray Suarez.
Thanks so much, Don.
Enjoy your time in St. Louis. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about community involvement in school improvement in the St. Louis area and how it impacts the entire region. And we'll certainly have some reference to tonight's program in which Ray is going to be such a big part. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.